Welcome back to this non-small cell lung cancer opinion leader workshop. So far we have covered with Alicia Sequist, EGFR and MET and HSP90. Alice Shaw has given us all the data regarding ALK and ROS1, RET, BRAF and KRAS. And Mark Chris has taken us through the emerging story in squamous cell carcinoma and small cell lung cancer. So in this final segment, we're going to look at some typical cases, at least I hope they're typical since I wrote them, and we'll discuss management and questions that might come up and get some roundtable opinions about this. So we'll start with Mark first with a squamous cell carcinoma, 67-year-old retired male truck driver, since some truck drivers are now female. With a 70-pack year smoking history, found to have a T3N3 squamous cell carcinoma of the right lower lobe with several 1 to 2 centimeter nodules in both lungs. He's initially treated in the community with 4 cycles of cisplatinum gemcitabine with improvement in his symptoms and a minor response by imaging studies. Approximately 5 months following completion of frontline chemotherapy, his symptoms return and imaging studies document disease progression. He's now referred for a second opinion. So should molecular analysis for oncogenic drivers be performed at this time since it was not done originally?
Well, I would say yes. And I would probably say the most important time though is to do it originally. If you go to the NCCN guidelines, it says you don't do this routinely, but you do it for patients that have tiny specimens, or you do it in folks that have never smoked. Obviously, this gentleman had smoked in the past, so they don't really know what size of specimen that they had. Again, there's more, the smaller the specimen that the pathologist has, the less likely sure they are that it is indeed a squamous cancer. So I think we are moving more and more to test up front. At this time, there are some potential targets you can find. Generally, some of the ones that we've seen in adenocarcinomas as well. Most of the targets, though, are for research at this point, and it would give a patient an additional option to go on a clinical trial. Also, obviously, there are more chemotherapy drugs that would be available for this patient in the second line setting. And we can discuss those as well. But I think the answer would be yes, I would test. But agreed that the options today are not in the hands of every MD.
So if either tissue is just not available, either from the original diagnosis or from metastatic lesions or progressive lesions at this point, you know, what are his therapeutic options? I mean, single-agent docetaxel, I guess, is a possibility. Nab-paclitaxel seems to have some activity in squamous cell carcinoma. Erlotinib has shown a little bit of activity, especially in the maintenance phase. But what about the immunotherapeutic agents you discussed and other clinical trials that might be available to this man?
Again, not to speak for the whole panel, but I think most folks would go for some kind of a taxane at that point. I think the jury's out whether one taxane is superior than another. I am a big favor of nab-paclitaxel because you don't have to give any steroids. There's no hypersensitivity reaction, and there's no worse way to give a patient an awful day than to give them a hypersensitivity reaction from a taxane, and that really goes away with that. Erlotinib, again, I'm going to quote ASCO. We should not be giving targeted therapies to people whose tumors don't have the target in 2014, and I think I'll leave it at that. And these other therapies here, we're very excited about it, anti-CTLA-4 therapy or PD-L1, but it's still at the research phase. And if this patient were interested in research, you know, I would definitely get their tumor tested for PD-L1.
And so PD-L1, Alicia, there seems to be some controversy as to how good either a biomarker PD-L1 is or how good the testing is, because some patients who are PD-L1 negative still respond to nivolumab and the anti-PD-L1 antibodies. What are your thoughts about that?
I agree. I think we still have a lot to learn. One of my personal best responding patients to one of these agents has been the one that was PD-L1 negative. But, you know, this isn't the same type of test that we think about with the genotypes where you can set it up yet in your hospital or you can send it off to a vendor. Each one of these drugs is being developed with a specific in-house PD-L1 test, a different antibody and different cutoff specificities that are kind of specific to that drug and that drug company. So, you know, each trial has its own specific requirements of whether you need a new biopsy, whether you can use archival tissue, or whether you don't have to submit any tissue. And some of the trials will let you on whether or not you're PD-L1 positive, and some require you be PD-L1 positive. At this point, we still are really learning a lot about it, and there's no definitive answer yet, in my opinion.
Alice, you agree?
I would agree.
Yeah, it's still pretty early in the whole course of these agents as their lifetime progresses.
But you know, I think Leisha's point about it being different than mutation is needs to be just mentioned again, because again, if you're looking for L858R, it's in virtually every cell in a tumor. When you look at these cells with these tumors and you look at PD-L1 expression, it's very heterogeneous across an individual tumor. And the smaller the tumor you have, the greater the chance that you're going to be able to make a kind of a misdiagnosis. So, and we really don't have a test. It's not like a mutation. It's totally different than that. And I think, you know, you need to follow the precepts of the trials, and I think time will tell if what's the right way to do this.
I've heard some thought that perhaps chemotherapy provokes the tumor to express PD-L1. So in someone like this who has already had 4 cycles of cisplatinum gemcitabine, are they more likely to be PD-L1 positive, or is that just who knows?
Well, because we don't have a reliable assay for who's PD-L1 positive, it's unfortunately very difficult to do that. Again, it has to do with the kind of biopsy. Any kind of, I'll call it cellular stress, be it chemo, be it radiation, be it radiofrequency ablation, you know, can change the tumor, make it more antigenic, I'll say. So all these things are possible, but these are still theoretical issues right now. Most of the testing, though, that's been done has been in people that have already had chemotherapy. So for better or worse, that's the majority of the data that's out there, though. Upfront testing and treatment is being done now.
So what about the presence of tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes? Is this a biomarker of sorts, and does this tend to indicate that this is someone who more likely has the T cells available to cooperate with the immune checkpoint inhibitor?
I've been horribly influenced by Li-Ping Chen from Yale, who has very nicely described this in melanoma and now in lung. Basically, for these agents to work, you need PD-L1 to be present, and you need tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes, TILs. And if they're not there, this mechanism doesn't work. It's like giving an EGFR drug to somebody who's EGFR wild type. And not everybody agrees with that, but to me, he's made a very compelling case. It's been published in Clinical Cancer Research for melanoma, and I believe the same is true for lung.
And what happens to the patients who don't respond? You have 2 patients who look pretty similar, whether they're PD-L1 positive or not. One gets a great durable response, and the other one doesn't. Do we know much about resistance mechanisms?
We know that's a good topic for a grant.
I should write one.
And I think we've all read a grant application to do that, but we don't know.
So any, Alice, Leisha, any thoughts about that? So we just have to wait until the studies are done. Okay.
I think it's an exciting time in lung cancer, and these things will unfold and reveal themselves over the next couple of years.
Right.
What's great for the patients is this plethora of new treatment options.
Yes.
And it appears to be in addition to everything we were talking about today. All the targeted therapies, cytotoxic chemotherapy, this is on top of that, and probably radiation too, frankly.
Well, let's move on. Let's look at the next case. So this is more in Leisha's area of presentation today. A 52-year-old female non-smoker diagnosed with advanced adenocarcinoma of the lung. She has an exon 19 deletion, EGFR mutant, receives erlotinib, gets a great response lasting 2 years, but now she has progressive disease in multiple areas. So she's not an oligometastatic person. She's symptomatic. She is rebiopsied, and one of the lesions demonstrates the T790M mutation. So at this point, what are her therapeutic options? Chemotherapy with cisplatinum and pemetrexed, and if you decide on chemotherapy, do you give erlotinib concurrently, or do you intercalate it with the chemotherapy? Is afatinib alone a reasonable choice, or should you combine afatinib with cetuximab? And then what about the more targeted EGFR inhibitors, the AstraZeneca drug and the Clovis drug?
So I think this is a very common case. There are a lot of patients like this out there, and so this is definitely something that's good to talk about and have everyone know what the most recent thinking is. I think because of early responses that have been seen in clinical trials with both of the bottom two drugs, the AZD9291 and the CO1686, these are very exciting options, especially for patients who have T790M, like this woman has been demonstrated to have. They are in early stage trials. They're not available everywhere, and many of the trial slots are available only at certain time points. So I think one thing that you could do is investigate whether it was possible to get on one of those trials. A lot of these trials do require yet another biopsy be done, so there's some logistical hurdles. But if that's an option, that would be my favorite, again, because of the activity that's been seen with both of these compounds. If a trial were not available, my personal next favorite would probably be chemotherapy with cisplatin, pemetrexed, and continued erlotinib. I think it's very important for EGFR patients to continue an EGFR inhibitor to prevent the flare phenomena. And the erlotinib and cis-pem is a very well-tolerated regimen. I usually don't do an intercalation where you stop the erlotinib for a certain number of days. I usually keep it going every single day and give the chemotherapy every 21 days. Afatinib cetuximab is also a very reasonable option. It is not possible to give it everywhere outside the setting of a clinical trial due to different payer issues, but if it is something that you can get approved, it has been shown to have good activity. Hopefully there will be an ECOG trial looking at this combination coming in the future that may be open through some of the intergroups as well. I think the only choice on this list that is a bad option is afatinib alone. So afatinib alone has not been shown active in patients who are already resistant to erlotinib. There was a randomized trial, the LuxLung-1 trial, led by Vince Miller, that showed essentially no benefit for this single agent treatment.
So if you decide on cis-pem or another chemotherapeutic regimen and you want to do concurrent EGFR inhibition, you should stay with erlotinib as opposed to switching to afatinib at this point?
I think so. If they were on first-line erlotinib, that's what I would do. Now, if they had been on first-line afatinib, I would probably actually stick with afatinib. Okay. We have less safety data combining afatinib with different chemotherapies, but there's no reason to think it would combine any less well than erlotinib.
Mark, you're shaking your head.
I totally agree with that, yeah.
Okay, and Alice, I assume?
I agree as well. I guess when I've combined platinum-pem with erlotinib, I have sometimes had to use an intercalated schedule because of toxicity issues sometimes. So I will sometimes have the chemotherapy and hold the erlotinib briefly, often the first few days after chemo. So I do use an intercalated schedule at times for toxicity reasons.
Right. And we don't forget the Bev either. So we would probably give these patients bevacizumab as well with pemetrexed and other chemotherapy.
Okay, so when you add the cis-pem, you would add in Bev as well?
I would. Okay. The same as I would use Bev in a setting where we didn't have the driver and it was part of our initial chemo choice.
Very good.
Not everybody does that. It seems to be very well tolerated. And, you know, just a reminder that chemotherapy really works in these patients.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And if you look at the IPAS data, the response rates are double in people that are EGFR mutation positive versus those that were not.
Those that are wild type.
So the chemo really works.
So, Alicia, you mentioned that the newer agents do not target EGFR wild type, so there's less diarrhea, less rash. And you also mentioned that you prescribe antibiotics at the beginning when someone starts on erlotinib or afatinib. Do the antibiotics ever exacerbate the diarrhea?
So antibiotics as a preventive strategy, I think, is most important with the second generation drugs like afatinib. Sometimes with erlotinib as well, especially if patients are very, very worried about a rash, just when I'm telling them about the drug, I will often start it with erlotinib as well. I usually use a minocycline or a doxycycline, which doesn't tend to exacerbate the diarrhea. It can sometimes cause some nausea for patients. But I don't think it interferes with the diarrhea too much.
Very good.
And Lyme disease, too.
That's right.
In the Northeast.
It's important in this part of the country.
It is.
Okay, so if patients relapse again and they're ready for third-line therapy, do you attempt to obtain a new biopsy and reevaluate their mutational status?
Absolutely. That may not be something that's ready for prime time in the community, but I think what we have learned, especially for patients with a driver mutation, is that the more biopsies we do, the more we learn about them.
And there's some practical things, too. There's this small cell transformation, which right. would open up drugs that would be traditionally used to fight small cell etoposide-based regimens. And also patients that have MET amplification, and we have MET agents now, we could right. ostensibly give crizotinib. I think the other thing to remember is the curve that I showed, that these people have a median survival of four years from the date of diagnosis of metastatic disease. So you have a lot of choices that need to be made. And I think, you know, to Alicia's point about biopsying these patients, you know, they're with us blessedly for a long time. And whatever additional option we can give these people, they deserve it and they want it.
Absolutely. So if someone is EGFR mutant, they respond to erlotinib, and they progress, and you rebiopsy them, and it turns out they've had a small cell transformation. Thinking back about those patients, are there any clinical features that would make you suspicious that they had transformed to small cell, the rate of progression or the distribution of metastatic disease? I would assume most of these people are non-smokers, and small cell is usually a smoker's disease. So the people who are light smokers, are they more likely to transform to small cell, or is it always a surprise?
We probably have the world's experts on this at this table.
I would say very clearly we have to distinguish this from de novo small cell. Don't think of this as whether their smoking had anything to do with this. This is an evolution of their EGFR mutant cancer. This is a mechanism of resistance to the erlotinib, not a second cancer that's appeared. Some of the patients have had very rapid clinical courses that have made people suspicious about small cell, but I have to say that some of them have had much more indolent courses too. So, and sometimes there are rapidly advancing cancers that don't have a small cell transformation. So I think it's hard to make broad strokes generalizations based on the clinical nature. But it is something that's seen in reliably in 5 to 10% of the biopsies, and it's something that we're trying to learn more about the biology and what it tells us about resistance.
And Alice, what has been your experience in treating these patients with platinum etoposide? Do they get a high percentage of responses? Are the responses short-lived or durable? What have you seen?
What I've seen is that these patients tend to respond like other small cell patients to a platinum etoposide regimen, so they actually tend to be quite sensitive to the chemotherapy. When I've had it, I've also continued their erlotinib and then added the platinum etoposide. And I have seen, I would say, fairly typical responses. Most patients will have a response. On average, the response seems to be typical in the sort of 4 to 6 month range or so with the combination.
And then are they likely to change their genotypic stripes once again?
Oh, gosh, I don't know if we know that. We have some biopsies after small cell progression. Maybe Alicia knows.
We've seen, you know, we have a couple of illustrative patients that have had multiple biopsies over the course of their life, and including an autopsy when they pass away, that, you know, I think I think there's basically selective pressure that you're putting on the cancer, and the cancer is just trying to escape by any mechanism. Right. So sometimes if you do stop the EGFR TKI, all the cancer reverts back to adenocarcinoma. We've seen that kind of in the era before this idea of continuing erlotinib for life was really popular. Now that patients are really on erlotinib for life or similar EGFR drug for life, I don't know if we'll see as much of that, but... I don't think we know enough about it to make a lot of clinical decisions. It's a very interesting research question right now.
This idea of erlotinib for life, though, it's not embraced by everybody yet. It's kind of interesting how quickly it became embraced in using trastuzumab for HER2-positive breast cancer, and for probably less data that it's a good strategy. It is a good strategy. I don't mean to say that. But also in prostate cancer, too, no one would think about stopping LHRH inhibition in patients once they're on it. So remember, these cancers are still oncogene addicted to EGFR.
Right.
If you see, if you look at a West, you see phospho-EGFR. I mean, it is there.
It's Leisha's iceberg again.
It's the iceberg.
Right. Yeah. So I think we've talked about this, and if they're MET amplified, what do you do? And you all, I think, mentioned that crizotinib is definitely an option. For these patients, and there have been other studies with the onartuzumab, and what about the HGF monoclonal antibodies like ralatumumab? Is that agent being looked at in non-small cell lung cancer? I know it's being looked at in gastric for MET amplified patients.
I think one of the practical concerns with MET amplified at the time of EGFR acquired resistance, and also from what I hear in gastric cancer patients, is a lot of this disease that's MET amplified tends to be very aggressive. It's in my experience, these patients have a very hard time with any further therapy. Crizotinib, I think to be effective for an EGFR mutant with MET amplification, you have to continue an EGFR inhibitor as well as a MET inhibitor, which is a little challenging to do outside the setting of a clinical trial.
I think a lot of people haven't been testing for it. I know in the Lung Cancer Mutation Consortium, I think for a lot of us, it was the first time that we routinely did it up front. And it's not common to have MET amplification.
Right.
So I think now, as we move to next gen, it'll be more common, but I think today there aren't a lot of cases out there, so there haven't been a lot of clinical trials. I think that crizotinib trial might be the only experience I know of that had MET amplified.
There's the Amgen MET inhibitor as well that's been looked at in MET amplified
lung
cancers, including lung. Yeah. I believe it included all advanced cancers.
Well, let's move on and look at ALK positive. So this is a younger male, former light smoker, diagnosed with a signet ring adenocarcinoma of the lung with distant mets. Mutational analysis demonstrates the EML4 ALK fusion, and therapies begun with crizotinib, and a nice partial response is obtained. 10 months later, he is progressing in multiple areas, although the brain remains clear, and you all mentioned what a sanctuary the brain is, so I'm sure that still needs to follow. So, what molecular studies should be done at this point, and does the mechanism of resistance to crizotinib impact the therapeutic decision?
So this is a common situation. Almost all patients at some point will relapse on crizotinib. It typically does seem to happen within the first 1 to 2 years. This patient was at about 10 months. And it's a very good question. We, of course, believe very strongly in pursuing biopsies of resistant tumors so we can understand resistance mechanisms. And, of course, those studies are so important in terms of discovering new strategies to target resistance. So in the proper setting, a biopsy can be done at an institution that's comfortable doing them. Of course, we would very much advocate the biopsy, but biopsies can't always be done. And I think in this particular situation with ALK, fortunately, the next therapy for these patients is not completely dependent on what the biopsies show. In fact, with the data that we have so far on the next generation ALK inhibitor, ceritinib, which is also LDK378, we've seen activity of that drug in patients who have become resistant to crizotinib, regardless of whether or not they've acquired a resistance mutation or not. As I mentioned, the response rate is about 60% in these patients, and again, just it doesn't matter, seems to not matter, what the underlying resistance mechanism is. I do think longer term, though, in terms of developing strategies that might be even more durable, knowing and understanding those resistance mechanisms will be important.
So we've talked about the fact that EGFR mutant patients seem to have a somewhat better prognosis no matter how they're treated, and they are more responsive to chemotherapy. What about the patients with ALK fusions? I understand their prognosis isn't quite as good.
You know, a number of studies have looked at this. This is somewhat of a challenging question because crizotinib was already available when ALK was discovered. So there are very few studies that can really evaluate ALK in isolation, meaning sort of the prognostic impact of just having an ALK rearrangement. But in the retrospective studies where that this has been done, it seems like ALK is somewhat neutral, meaning that it's not positive. It doesn't seem to be a positive prognostic factor the way EGFR could be. And I would say negative. It seems to have the same poor prognosis as sort of the general non-small cell lung cancer population. Nevertheless, I know in Mark's presentation on LCMC data and also in our own institutional series where we've looked at ALK and sort of outcomes of patients with ALK rearrangement, we have seen very prolonged overall survivals from metastatic diagnosis in the four-year range mark. So it seems like these patients, while their prognosis may be similar to sort of the non-selected population, they may very well be benefiting from all of these new therapies, the ALK inhibitors, the chemotherapies that we have, and other treatments as well.
Very good. All right, let's see. I think there might be one more slide. So
can I ask Alice a question?
Absolutely.
So I'm in practice. I have the expanded use ceritinib trial open to me, and I have crizotinib, and I have a newly diagnosed patient with ALK-positive cancer. What should I do first?
So right now, you have no option other than to do crizotinib because expanded access is only for previously treated.
Well, you caught me on that one.
Yes, but when it becomes approved.
Yes, when it becomes approved.
Okay. So ceritinib may be approved. The filing was submitted actually at the end of 2013, and no one yet knows what the label will read. Will it be for just crizotinib resistance? Will it be for all ALK-positive lung cancer? So we don't know. If it's open and for all ALK-positive lung cancer, it will bring up this issue of when do we only save it for crizotinib resistance or do we use it up front? And perhaps by using the more potent ALK inhibitor up front, you might have more durable remissions than what we see with crizotinib. Problem is we have no data on that. So there is no data. There is no current head-to-head trial of ceritinib versus crizotinib. And the data that we do have on ceritinib in crizotinib-naive patients is still maturing. So we don't even know what the median progression-free survival is on frontline ceritinib. So I think we have to wait a little bit. So if you're conservative, then it would make sense to go ahead just to go with crizotinib. I think there may be certain reasons why you would be interested in frontline ceritinib, for example, in the setting of brain metastases. And many of these patients will present with small asymptomatic brain metastases. They are very not enthusiastic about radiation therapy. You may not be enthusiastic about it. And in that setting where we have seen really good activity of ceritinib in the brain, that may be an indication to using ceritinib frontline.
Any problems with giving ceritinib and cranial irradiation simultaneously?
Well, we never do that. The trials never allowed that, so there's really no safety data on that.
And the same with crizotinib, pretty
much. Same with crizotinib.
Right, very good. And so what about alectinib and
it's just stopping it for like 2 days before, though.
Right.
If I remember the story,
it's
2 days before and restarted 2 days later.
And restarting. Mm-hmm. So if you don't have ceritinib available to you in an expanded access, but you do have availability to the clinical trials with alectinib or the Ariad drug, or you have lines of referral to those agents, are those potential choices? And if there's progression, can you go back to ceritinib? Or is there anything really known about sequencing all of these agents?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's just the field is evolving very quickly, so we don't have answers to those questions. I would say that alectinib and ARIAD are both in clinical trials. They're both in phase two. They're specifically for crizotinib-resistant patients, although the ARIAD study will also allow crizotinib-naive patients. So I would say yes, for a patient you have who's relapsed on crizotinib, either ceritinib or alectinib or the 113 compound are good options. Neither alectinib nor the ARIAD drug will allow anything other than prior crizotinib,
okay.
So you can't have failed crizotinib and ceritinib. You won't be able to access alectinib or ARIAD in that setting.
Very good. Okay. All right. I think we've tied you all up for long enough. Any final comments or questions? We're good? All right. Well, thank you all for watching this Opinion Leader Workshop in Non-Small Cell Lung Cancer. I hope you've enjoyed it and learned a great deal, and we will hopefully be bringing more of these programs to you in the future. And thanks to Leisha, Alice, and Mark for participating in this very interesting program. Thanks again.
Thanks. Thank you.